Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to a very special segment of Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I've got Mindworm Games' Benson Green with us.
Hey everybody, how's it going? It's great to be back on the show.
I don't know what we're calling this. Like, so you want to be a game designer? welcome to game design. Intro to GD 101.
I think I have a book about how to be an author, like a writer. That I think it's like called like slamming your head against the wall for fun and profit. Yeah. It's about like that.
Welcome to hours of desperation, and there could be some crying.
Most definitely, yeah. There's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in any miniature.
Well, you're doing it. I mean, you're quote unquote living the dream, essentially. And so, I want to talk to you about your experiences, because this can be a very intimidating just process to get in. And I'm going to turn this into a series. After our segment, I'm going to have another segment with someone else. So we're going to expand on this, and then I'm going to run the segment that we did originally. So, I think we can make this blend into that one pretty well with some of the things that we want to talk about.
Cool.
So I want to talk about how to build a miniature pipeline. You've got something in your mind. You're building a game that requires pieces or miniatures of any type, and we want to get it. So you've got some art, and you want to bring it to life.
Ah, you don't have art yet.
So So we're pre-art.
Yeah. You're pre-art. Miniatures start as an idea, right?
Fair. Okay, so cool. This will blend in. So go ahead and...
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about sculpting last time, but one of the things that I think we didn't talk so much about was concept art. That's where miniatures start. Where miniatures start is in the mind of the person who wants to make the miniature. Like you want to produce this miniature, whether you're the sculptor or whether you're just a dude with a game that needs pieces, or whether you want to put up miniatures just for people to paint and display, or even if it's just, if you're doing busts or that kind of thing, however it is, you have something that you want to do. And it's locked in your head, right? And I think that's where most new game developers or people that are just entering into the miniatures gaming world, they've got something in their brain and they want to get it out into the physical world. And that has to start somewhere, right? There has to be some process to get it from your head into some kind of expressed form, some kind of artistic expression. And if you don't do artwork yourself, and a lot of people who have game companies don't actually do the artwork themselves, then you've got to find people to start that process.
So we are going to talk about how to birth that pipeline for when things in a pipeline, what I'm talking about is to make sure you get something produced and then you have something already coming behind it to feed the filling gaps, be the next thing that you do, the expansion or the next group. Maybe you've already created the antagonist and you need some protagonist. You know, that's the kind of stuff. You're creating a system in which you get produced and finished goods.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that's an important thing to keep in mind is you are producing something that you want to sell to people. You're producing a finished good. And when it comes to making games, if you have miniatures, that's the longest pipeline. So it's important to have that established and to kind of know what goes into that pipeline so that you know how much time you need to have before you put out a new release. So, you know, we're working on, like I said last time we were talking, I'm way behind schedule and I'm 7 months from a release and we're getting sculpting going. And I'm like, ooh, man, we're up against it.
Oh, I mean, we can chuckle, but that could be a very real thing. So tell me, but what is from the cradle to the grave, from when you hatch an idea for a character to when you can hold the character in your hand?
Sure. So a really quick breakdown of the process is you have an idea and you have to communicate that idea to an artist. Now, typically it starts with a concept artist. You don't always have to have concept art when you go to a sculptor, but sculptors do very, very well with concept art. So I'd always recommend having a piece of concept art first and then going to a sculptor with that concept art. So you take your idea, you express it in some way, whether you describe it in words or you use reference images from the internet or, you know, or you create your own crude sketches. But whatever you do, you communicate that idea to an initial artist who kind of works it around and creates the first expressions of it. And that's what we call concept art. So you take your concept and you make it into some sort of product. And then you have to get that concept art to a sculptor, and that sculptor will create the sculpt, whether it's a traditional sculpt or it's a digital sculpt. And there's a lot of things to consider when you're approaching a miniature with both of those. And then once you have the sculpt, then you need to start the production process. And if you do digital sculpting, you have to create a physical object from that digital sculpt. So that means 3D printing. And then if you have a traditional sculpt, you have to take that potentially fragile original and start making that into a thing that you can put into the manufacturing pipeline. And so you have to, either way, you have to get master casts of it. So you take that original physical object, and then you create some initial casts from that. And then from those casts, you create your production casts.
I'm sweating already just thinking about this.
Yeah, exactly right. And the more control over the process you have, you know, in a lot of ways, it's better. So we do all the manufacturing in-house at Mindworm Games, which gives me a lot of room to kind of relax a little bit. So, for example, like we have a product that was supposed to come out in December, and then it was supposed to come out at the end of January. Of course, it's January 31st now, right? And it's not out because I'm waiting on the master cast to arrive from Germany. But I'm not so worried about that, because once I have those casts in my hand, I can make production molds inside 2 days. Because I have it right here in my house.
That's pretty cool. But let's take it back to the original. You said concept art helps a lot with design. And I'd like to kind of walk through that for a minute, because I think we've all been in that situation where it's like the telephone game, where we describe something exactly how we perceive it to someone else. And then how they perceive it based on our description is completely different.
Or even subtly different, right? And that's why concept art, I think, is really important, because sculpting is a difficult medium. It takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of effort, and it's hard to change it. Whereas concept art can be a lot more fluid. So it's a lot easier to work with an artist and do quick revisions. And you can start with like really rough sketches and what we call them comps, right? So you can start with a bunch of, you know, comparable pieces and say, oh, I like that, or I like that, and I don't like this, what you do it over here, so why don't we take these elements and put them together. So it's a lot more of a quick and dirty fluid process, and that's kind of the idea behind concept art.
Okay, so when you get this, where do you go to get the concept art? I think we're being a little bit remedial here with stuff we already talked about, but how do you start searching out the first concept art? And you can be brief with that, because I know we talked about it.
Yeah, sure. It's, you know, anywhere you find, you know, two-dimensional artists is where you pick up somebody for concept art. If you see really cool concept art on the internet, another great way is to find out who did that work and then go contact them and say, oh, I love your work here. Like we're working with a guy named Owen out in California. He did a lot of concept art for this game Twisted, which I really like. I really like the miniatures and I really like the concept art for it. And so I just, you know, figured out who he was and sent him a message. And now we're working together on some pieces.
All right. So now you've got the concept art, and then you want to get that to a sculptor?
Yeah. So I'm going to back up just a little bit real quick. And because you mentioned trying to express your idea, and I think it's really important to kind of talk about your sort of expectations and how you manage that sort of relationship, because that's really important. It's like a lot of times what happens is that as a freelance artist, your biggest concern, or one of your biggest concerns, in my opinion, and in my experience, is you need to create a work product that's going to satisfy your client. And it's a lot easier to do that if you know what your client's expectations are. And so as the client, the way you can make it that job easier on the artist is not only being very, very specific and very careful about what exactly your expectations are, being very clear about that, but also leaving yourself open to allow room for the creative process to happen. So I try to shelve my expectations. And my goal when working with any artist, sculptor or concept artist, but especially a concept artist, is to shelve my expectations and create a space within the art, within which the artist can be creative, but also can feel comfortable knowing that the pieces he's making, or he or she is making, will meet with my expectations. I call that the zone of comfort, right? You want to provide firm boundaries that tells the artist, this is the realm you should be working in, and this is what I expect to see.
Has to have this kind of hat.
Yes,
exactly. Has to have this kind of gun or something.
Yes.
You give him some must-haves, and then you give them a little bit of flexibility for their own artistic talent.
Exactly. So, for example, I had a brief that I wrote up recently for the pieces we're working on with Owen, and one of them it's a woman in like a pioneer-y type dress, and so my reference deck, it's a PowerPoint slideshow, we call it a deck, and my reference deck of just images I collected, I have four different dresses in there. And the reason why I have four different dresses is because I want to give him some options so that he can exercise his creativity. So he can look at those and say, all right, well, these are the types of dresses Benson is looking for. He wants these sorts of things in this dress, but this gives me some idea about where I can kind of pick and choose. Do I want to make the sleeves a little bit like that? Or do I want to make the skirt, you know, kind of like this dress? And it kind of, it gives, you know, some room to play around. And then and you need to leave yourself open to be surprised, because, like, you know, especially if you're not an artist, right? Like, I'm not an artist. And so I expect to be pleasantly surprised when an artist comes back with a piece.
I get it. So you have things that are important to you. And obviously if you're designing this, you're creating this, heck, this could even be like, as me, I know that I have some beloved characters in my mind that I love to get out there. And I have some things that have to be there, or else they aren't that character. What you're wanting to do is communicate that to the artist, and so they know where their hard lines have to be.
Exactly. Right. And then the other thing about the concept art, if you want it to go to a sculptor, is if you need to communicate something very specific to the sculptor, like, you know, I need, this is a new science fiction-y gun, and I have a very specific idea about how this gun should look, that's an opportunity to go to a concept artist and say, all right, I need you to specifically draw this gun from a couple of different angles so the sculptor knows exactly what I'm looking for, right?
Or maybe what it specifically should not look like.
Yeah, it don't look like this. Yeah, so then you have your concept art, and you go to your sculptor. And again, you find sculptors the same way you find concept artists. You find pieces that you like, and you go out and find out who did those pieces. But once you have your concept art, you go to your sculptor. What I like to do personally for a sculptor, again, because I like to kind of open up my expectations and allow room for creativity, I like to give the sculptor the concept art plus all the material I gave to the concept artist, right? So you have everything he was working with, he or she was working with, plus this finished product. And I'm not expecting the sculptor to recreate the concept art. That's one thing that concerns me a little bit about how things get done in the miniatures industry right now, is I see a lot of companies expecting artists to recreate concept art almost exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And you might wonder, like, well, that's what I want, right? I have this guy, he made artwork that's exactly what I want, and I want the sculptor to do exactly that. The problem I have with that is you're hiring an artist, right? You're hiring somebody who's a creative individual, and you are buying their creativity because you don't have it, right? So they not only have skills, right? It's not just technical skill, it's also talent and creativity that you're purchasing.
Something you would never have had you not gotten them to do this.
Exactly, right. And so if you're asking that person to duplicate another artist's work in a different medium, that doesn't leave any room for that other artist to exercise his or her own creativity. And so I think it kind of does a disservice to the sculptor when you kind of put in roadblocks like that.
I like that, but to play the other side of it, sometimes, you know, you're not always going to feel that way, and you don't always have that flexibility. But I think it does, what you're doing is building a relationship.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Right. We talked a lot about relationships last time. So once you have your sculpt, then you got, like I said, you go into the other parts of the manufacturing process. But I think we should probably take a step back again and look at some of the practical considerations with concept art and sculpting, and some of the different challenges you might face in those stages of the production process. Then we can talk about that also with mastering and production and the challenges you might face there.
We might even have to break the mastering and production segment.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
But I mean, because I think that's going to be something that does have a little bit of weight to it, but let's just take it one step at a time.
Yeah, sure. So if you look at concept art, as with any sort of artwork, you can pay, you know, any sort of amount, you know, it just, you know, there's the prices are going to fluctuate. For my company and for a lot of other companies, I think in this space, concept art tends to run, depending on what kind of level of rendering. So like the quality of the finished piece, how much detail is in it and whatnot, how polished it is. Depending on the quality of the piece, you're looking at anywhere from, you know, $100 to $300. That's sort of my framework for concept art.
Sometimes you might feel full character, not a logo. Yeah. That's like for a human type figure with all the trimmings that comes with that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that, so it might be, you know, front view and side view. It might be specific equipment, and you might get some variability around that. So sometimes you might get concept art for less than $100. But given that the amount of time it takes to do concept art, I wouldn't expect anything, anything much less than $100. And then if you're paying more than $300 for concept art, you're sort of in the realm of proper illustration. and beyond the realm of sort of this like rough concept art.
I mean, that's how you should couch it. So if you're spending this, then expect that
from exactly right.
What it is. If you're spending less, then expect whatever that Y is. You know, like when I get art from Fiverr every now and then, which is a really cool melting pot of, you know, typically a bunch of either people from foreign countries or whatever that are good at some of these things that I'm not good at, and they will charge me to do that. And,
yeah, exactly.
But right. I also have a big expectation around, okay, this cost me $15. Is it exactly what I want? Sometimes yes, sometimes no, but that's still framed around what I spent on it.
Yeah, sure. Exactly right. And so, like I said, $100 to $300 is a good range for concept art in this space. And I think if you go out and start looking at concept artists, that's about what you can expect to pay. Now, some people might look at that and say, well, if I'm paying $500, $600, $700 for a sculpt, that adds a lot of cost doing concept art. And it does.
It's insurance. So
yeah, exactly right. But another thing I would mention about the value of concept art is that you want to, generally speaking, you want to be careful about overproducing art assets, and you want to be able to make sure that you can use your art assets in lots of different ways. So when we create concept art, we make sure that we can use that concept art. It's good enough that we can use it for card art, that we can use it for promotional materials, that I can put it on the covers of books, right? That you can repurpose it and rework it into lots of different usage, and you get a lot more mileage out of it that way.
Work this into your conversations with the artist too, because those are all licensed activities.
It wouldn't be if you're doing a work for hire. Those aren't licensed activities because you own the work, right? So you can do whatever the hell you want with it. But it's important to let the artist know what you're planning on doing with it. So I have a section in my briefs which says this is what we're going to be using this for, right? And the reason why that's in there is because if the artist might need to know, if like say they're working in Photoshop, most artwork is digital these days. If they're working in Photoshop, they need to know, I should probably put this on a different layer from the background so that you can lift that off the background and use it in a different context.
Okay.
Or the artist might need to know, all right, well, I might charge you more because you're getting more use out of it. So I might charge you, you know, more money for it, but I'm not just going to give you a JPEG or a PDF of this thing. I'm going to give you the full Photoshop file. And so I'll make sure all my layers are intelligible and they're labeled all correctly. And you can kind of mess around with it and rework it if you need to.
I like that.
Yes, that's what we make sure to do. Make sure all of our concept artists, if they're working digitally, they give us the full Photoshop files, and hopefully the layers are intelligible, so I know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, if I can just interject here, to my point is that if you know ahead of time everything that you're going to be using with the art or what you plan to do with it, communicate that to the artist. I'm willing to bet that most of them won't care. Some of them will say that's $10 more.
yeah. But you're right. Most of them are not going to care. Most of them won't care. It's important, like I said, to think about what you're going to be doing with the artwork and what your needs are, and seeing where you can get the most value from the development costs you are putting in.
Yeah, one of them may become a book cover, and then you've already got that. So you're
exactly right. Yeah, your book cover might become your box art. And your box art might become, you know, that little part of your box art might become a logo on your website, or it might also become some card art somewhere. So anyhow, and there are people you can talk to.
You breeze past that, but that's very important, I think, to kind of have worked out beforehand that you even get that option, so you don't have to kind of go back and unwind something again where 10 years down the road, where maybe that artist is not your friend anymore. You're not that artist friend anymore.
Yeah, exactly right.
and I'm not trying to talk about the ugly side of it. I'm just talking about of the things that can be surprises, and all this forward thinking that we're trying to inject to people, I think, prevent those late game surprises.
Yeah, well, there's surprises enough. You don't need to be creating more surprises for yourself, because another thing about the pipeline for miniatures, because you're talking about working with multiple artists, especially if you're doing a range of miniatures and there's going to be multiple concept artists and multiple sculptors, they're all working together trying to make pieces that work together. That's a really complicated process, and there are going to be surprises, there are going to be setbacks, there's going to be challenges, and it's a good idea to not create more for yourself than are going to naturally happen.
I like it. So I didn't mean to jump in there.
Continue. No, that was great. Yeah. So the other thing is, all right, so if you move on from concept art to sculpting, so you've got your nice piece of concept art. The first big thing to think about with respect to sculpting is your manufacturing process. You should have that in mind before you hire a sculptor. How is this miniature going to get produced? Is it going to be spin cast metal? Is it going to be gravity cast resin? Is it going to be produced for injection molded? Is it high impact polystyrene like GW's miniatures, or is it going to be produced in a rustic material or some other kind of a material with like an aluminum mold? So there's all kinds of different things to consider, because the way the piece is sculpted has to be done with all these practical considerations in mind. So you have to know what you're going to be doing in the manufacturing process before you even hire a sculptor.
Okay, so plan out how you're going to, and what do you mean during the manufacturing process? The press molding, spin molding, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So if I'm going to be doing a spin cast metal miniature, that miniature needs to be sculpted differently than if I'm doing a miniature that's cast in resin.
I mean, do you expect the artist that you're working with to know this already, or do you just have to tell them this thing has to be done in this certain way? It's got to be a one piece, point in this direction, within a certain space diameter.
If you are new, I highly recommend spending more money to find an artist that is familiar with working with the manufacturing process you intend to use. Because if you don't know the manufacturing process inside and out, it is going to be fraught with challenges. Because if you find an artist that doesn't know what they're doing, that might be a great artist, but doesn't know how to make a piece that's going to survive not only the physical world, but also the manufacturing process you want to do, and you can't communicate exactly what you need, then you're going to run into a lot of problems. So the shortcut there, if you're not intimately familiar, like I'm pretty damn familiar with how to make spin cast metal miniatures. I make my own molds. I cast my own miniatures.
I'm still astounded by that.
Yeah, no, it's pretty crazy. Anyhow, but I have an idea about how the process works and what the needs are and what the challenges are. But if you're not familiar with that, you really need to go find an artist that's creating pieces designed for the manufacturing process that you intend to use. And it's also a good idea, in my opinion, to find an artist that's already kind of working in a style with proportions and kind of a level of detail that you want to see in your miniatures. Because then you can just say, look, man, Patrick, Keith, I love your Bombshell Babes miniatures. You just do that, right? So here's a brief, and we don't have to go into detail about how the proportion should be, because I like these miniatures. I like that you cast them like this. Just do that for me. And that saves you a lot of trouble down the line. And that might cost you a little bit more, because you might have to go to somebody that has a big portfolio and has worked with a lot of different customers.
Okay, I'm following now.
Yeah, and so the big consider, so once you know how you're going to manufacture the miniature, then you can go hire a sculptor. And the second big thing to decide when you're going to go hire a sculptor is, do you want to sculpt digitally, or do you want to sculpt traditionally with like putty, like whether it's bees putty or it's green stuff or Fimo or whatever it is, some kind of, you know, epoxy. Because there's a different manufacturing pipeline for each one of those. Now there's advantages and disadvantages to both. So digital sculpting is a big thing nowadays, and the advantages for digital sculpting is that there's a lot less risk involved in it. You can if you make an oopsies when you're in the production pipeline of a digital sculpt, you can fix it. So like if you have a falling out with an artist, you can get the files. You know, assuming you can get the working files from the artist, you can give them to another artist and have them keep working on it. If you 3D print the miniature and then you break it, like you drop it on the floor and it shatters into 500 pieces, you can just go print another one. It'll cost you money and time, but it's not going to cost you as much money or as much time as having a brand new miniature hand sculpted by the artist.
Yeah.
So there is safety there. Plus you can also modify digital sculpts easier. So if you have like, you know, a soldier dude, and you want like five different soldier dudes, sometimes you can save a lot of costs by having the digital sculptor reuse a lot of the work without having to do resin casts of it and then hand modify the resin cast, although you can do that with traditional sculpting. And then the final thing, I guess, with digital sculpting is that you can also repurpose the pieces. Like you can scale them up, you can scale them down within certain limits, and then you can make like little busts, you can make little, you know, make, you know, sell just the heads and some other stuff like that.
Well, I know there's people out there that just say, I don't prefer digital casting. I prefer this type of casting to that type mm-hmm. of casting. Is there really any legitimate difference between them?
There's a world of difference.
The after product.
Oh yeah, absolutely. 100%.
Okay, let's hear it.
First of all, there's an aesthetic difference. I'm reasonably certain I could take a Pepsi challenge and identify, and if you put 10 miniatures in front of me, I bet I can pick out the 5 digital sculpts from production cast. You can always spot a digitally sculpted miniature if you know what you're looking for. I think they have a different sort of look. They're a little bit more processed, a little bit more sterile. They don't have
eyes on them.
Exactly right. And I think they're just a little bit more soulless to me, right? So that's why I like traditional sculpted miniatures. They're also easier to work with in the production process, right? That's the other advantage you get with the traditional sculpt. And they're also, you have a lot less exposure to challenges, because the big challenge with digital sculpting is you have to 3D print the thing. And that's another person you're adding that has their own set of specialties, and they've got to come in behind it. They've got to build supports for that. They've got to decide what kind of material they're printing it in, and that material has to be appropriate for your manufacturing process. Is it going to be a resin that you can put into a vulcanized rubber mold? Is it going to be a wax that is safe for room temperature vulcanized silicone, but you can't subject it to heat, right? All those considerations go into it.
So who knows this type of stuff? Or whose responsibility is it to know this type of stuff? I think that's what I want to ask.
It is your responsibility to know that.
Oh, I was afraid you're going to say that.
Yes, it is always your, in my personal view, is if it's your company and your money and your idea, it is always your responsibility. Now, you can, having accepted that responsibility, you can make sure that you hire somebody that knows what they're doing, right?
Because I have a game idea. So I just want to walk through all the steps and figure out if this is for me.
Yeah, exactly right. So like I said before, if you're just starting out, the simplest thing to do is decide how you want to do something, like what production process you're going to use, what proportions you like, what you want to happen, and find someone that's already doing that and say, look, you're already doing that. You have a proven track record. I want you to do it for me. Because that's the other thing with digital sculpting. There's a risk in there that you get an artist that might come from the video game industry, and they might have never made a piece that's supposed to stand up on a tabletop and not fall over,
mm-hmm.
right? Whereas a traditional sculptor is safer in that sense, because they have, while they're building it, it has to stand up on the table, right? While they're building it, it has to be big enough that it's going to be manufacturable. So in my experience, traditional sculptors, you have a much higher likelihood of getting somebody that can make a miniature that will be manufacturable and that will be usable. So like I said, like it's, you can't, being able to manufacture it is one thing, but it's also a gaming piece. It has to stand up to handling and abuse and painting. It has to have details that are chunky enough that they're not going to get obscured.
Oh, just wait till you hear about my idea.
What's your idea?
No, I'm not going to tell you yet. Okay. We'll talk about it in a minute.
All right. Well, all right. So if you have a traditional, if you go to a traditional sculptor, in my experience, it's safer in the sense that you're going to be getting somebody who knows what they're doing in terms of the manufacturing pipeline. Whereas digital sculptors right now, the market's a little bit more like the Wild West, where you're getting some great artists that produce really nice renders, but a render is not a finished product, right? A great render usually does not equal a great miniature. And that's another.
They'll sell a render. Like, here's my render in this format. And if you want it in any other format, you have to pay more or whatever.
Well, or if they do a Kickstarter, for example, they're like, we haven't done production yet, so here's the renders. And people are like, well, the renders look great. But that render has not been 3D printed. Like, the problem with the render is that you're getting a really skewed view of the miniature, right? Because it's so blown up, right? I mean, it would be like taking your miniature and staring at it under a magnifying glass, right? Whereas these miniatures are designed to be painted at like, at least a foot or so.
Arm's length kind of thing.
Arm's length. Yeah, at least held at arm and played at 3 feet, right? You're playing this thing at 3 feet away minimum. You're probably going to be, enjoying it at arm's length. You're not going to be sticking it up under to your face under a magnifying glass. And so renders can kind of be deceiving, especially because as part of the manufacturing process, there is a consistent detail loss all throughout the process.
Every time you do something else, it's going to have some type of detail loss, right?
Exactly. Every single time anyone touches that miniature, you lose detail. So when you have a digital sculpt, you go to the 3D printer, you lose detail. You take that 3D print, you put it into a master mold, you lose detail. You take that master, you put it into a production mold, you lose detail again.
Where are we in the pipeline process right now? We're going to keep kind of going back to it, but where, of all the things we talked about, where are we in the pipeline?
Right now, we're deciding what kind of sculptor we want to hire. We're not even there yet.
Right? I thought you were going to say like ready to master mold.
No. Right now, you're deciding whether you're going to go traditional sculpting or digital sculpting, and then you're deciding what sculptor you want to hire.
And how long have we been working on this process in our hypothetical here?
Hypothetically, concept art, it can take at least a few weeks. I would give at least 2 weeks for concept art, and that depends on the artist's availability.
So not a lot of time. We haven't had enough time for all of our fears of failure to set in.
Sure, yeah. And preferably you decided about manufacturing process before you even hired a concept artist, right?
Okay. We should include that because I wasn't thinking that far ahead.
Well, you don't have to. It's not a given, but you know, it's good to have an idea about what your plan is before you start spending any money, generally speaking. It doesn't cost anything to decide how you want to manufacture the miniatures. Once you decide what you're going to do, whether it's digital sculpting or traditional sculpting, and once you decide how much expertise you need to buy, right? Because you're buying expertise, right? So for example, if you hire Patrick Keith, you know that he's sculpted hundreds of miniatures that have all been manufactured in either resin or spin cast metal. And so he knows what he's doing. Or you might go to another sculptor and take a look at their portfolio and be like, okay, I see that miniature he sculpted for this company. I have that on my shelf. I can go take that miniature that I see that he sculpted digitally. I can hold it in front of my face and say that translated well to a physical product. I know he knows what he's doing. Right. And so once you're comfortable with the level of expertise you're buying or communicating, right? So you're going to train the artist how to do it. Then you can proceed to the sculpting. Now sculpting, that can take a long time. I would allow at least a month per miniature.
A month per miniature in the sculpting phase.
Yeah, and that's a safe estimate. You might be able to get stuff done faster than that. So for example, right now I'm talking about Patrick Keith a lot because we just signed a contract with him to sculpt some of our miniatures. He's going to be doing 4 miniatures for us in February. So he's doing 4 in 1 month, but that's a really, you know, we're behind schedule. So he's packing it in. So I had to sweet talk him a little bit.
Yeah.
I just sweet talked to get him to do that kind of schedule. But I think even on his website, he says 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
And that's reasonable. And so you should always plan it for at least a month because you want to at least consider that there might be delays. And there's probably going to be delays.
There's going to be some kind of delay. Something is going to happen.
Yes, whether you need to do revisions.
Which could be on your side too. I'm not saying the artist. I'm just meaning something's going to happen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. You might forget to respond to an artist's email, right? He might send you, you know, pictures of the wire dolly. Or the armature talking about the pose, and you might forget to email them back for, you know, 3 or 4 days. Well, that's
in my not radio life. I also manage projects. It's part of what I do. And, you know, everybody's got excuses, but the end of the day is that something happened that is preventing us from moving along on schedule. But if you're in your, which you would be doing your project manager, if you're a good enough project manager, you either already built that into your system, some amount of float, you know, or you're prepared to figure out how that doesn't affect you.
Yeah, exactly. You can figure out how to work around it. And so, you know, generally speaking, you know, in the miniatures industry, if you throw more money at the problem, you can solve most issues. Like, you know, so if you really slammed and you need to get miniatures done, you can be like, look, guy, can you set aside all your other work? I'll pay you double, right? Like you might be able to throw some money at the problem. But if you have a comfortable, you know, lead time, you should be fine. So if you assume 1 month per miniature, I think that's probably a good starting point. And that'll take into account some miniatures come out quickly, some miniatures take longer, sometimes there's problems. But you also have to consider shipping time. Right. Because these are, you know, if it's a digital sculpt, you can email a file or link to it to download a file immediately. But once you have a physical object, you now have to deal with the mail. and that has to get mailed all over the place, right? So if you have,
that's, they don't, that, they don't care about your game.
Yeah, exactly right. They don't care about your game, and you also need to be cognizant about what the turnaround time is through the production process. And my experience right now with 3D printing, that's like what also scares me about digital sculpting is that the market is expanding dramatically, and there's only the choke points I think right now in the production pipelines are 3D printing and casting. Those are the two big choke points. You can find plenty of artists to do the work. But once you have a digital file, there's only so many 3D printing companies that know how to 3D print a miniature in a proper way to make it come out, to make that kind of thing, that small of a thing, come out looking good.
Okay.
So like there's like Knuckle Duster Miniatures, Vision Proto is another good one. And there's several other companies out there that will do it. But because there's so much work going around, a lot of these companies might tell you, you know, 2 weeks. There's going to be a 2-week turnaround in every single miniature. So now your 1 month turned into a month and a half, right? And that's if there's no problems in the printing. So I think with the Blackwater Gulch Kickstarter production that we're doing, I'm waiting on digital sculpts to become 3D printed originals that I can start putting into production. And right now we just found out that some of the digital sculpts, there's some kind of polygon problem. Like I don't know much about the process. That's another reason why it makes me nervous is that I don't know like all these different little things that go into it.
A little bit and of so review.
Yeah, there's some techno babble problem. I'm like, what techno babble problem? Like what? I didn't know that was a problem, right? Like that's the other problem with not having an intimate knowledge of the process is that there can be delays that you were not expecting, and so that's going to slow down the process because now it has to go back to the artist. The artist has to fix that problem and then send it back to the 3D printer, and then he's got to print the pieces again, which is a slowdown in time and money. That's not a huge deal, right? It's a solvable problem and it's not a long delay, but it is a delay.
And you can also with the people that you're working with, you start to establish what the time they tell you, what that really equates to. Sometimes it's going to be sooner. Like, you know, okay, you know what? I've been working with Benson for a year. I know what the Benson hours is. You know, like, so if he gives me say it's going to be a 30-hour job, I'm going to get it in a certain amount of Benson hours.
Exactly. And that's, again, why I also prioritize relationships. You always want to have a nice, firm working relationship, good, trusting relationship. And you want to have vendors that you know how to work with. And I do this in my day job, too. We've got vendors that we work with that, you know, I know this person's going to do a good job in these parts of the country. This person is going to do a good job in these other parts of the country. And so that's also why I told Tim Erickson from Gang Fight Games and the Blackwater Gulch thing, one of the reasons why I recommended that he do his 3D printing with Knuckle Duster Miniatures is because I've worked with Forrest before, Forrest Harris at Knuckle Duster Miniatures. I know his process. I know what material he prints in. I know how he prints. And I've worked with his 3D prints before. So I know I can work with his stuff. And I know also that Forrest is an honest guy who's not going to give me a print that I can't manufacture. Forrest is the kind of person who will say, I could take your money and I could print it and I could give you the print, but I'm not going to do that because if I give you this, it's going to get screwed up. And so that's a very valuable.
People that are willing to share their advice at that level, I think are good.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah. And so, you know, we already headed off a couple of problems because Forrest is that kind of guy, right? So we didn't, you know, he said, here are some problems with these miniatures that need to get fixed. And so we, you know, Tim's been fixing them. But anyhow, you need to know all these little details about the process. And so anyhow, so I guess we're talking about timeline. So if we're at a month for sculpting plus another 2 weeks for 3D printing, if you're doing a 3D print, and then once it's a physical object, you have to consider time to send that to the various people that are going to touch it, right? So if you're contracting out your casting, let's say you're using Valiant as a contract casting services, or Zombie Smith, if you're using their contract casting services, or Iron Wind Metals or whatever. That little 3D printed original has to get sent in the mail to that individual, and then you have to understand that company's turnaround time. So Valiant, right now, I would probably say you're looking at 2 months turnaround time on average from Valiant, unless you talk them into something differently, right?
And that's, and 2 months when you're just beginning things does not seem like a hard time. 2 months when you have just arranged your demo and the campus college campus, when that's exit down on their game day that you want to make sure everything's there for, and it's the day after the 2 month, right after that 2 month window, then it's going to seem like it's, you know, a little bit of time.
Let's say you're scheduled to be at Adepticon or at Gen Con. Like last year, we were launching our company at Gen Con, and I had some like moments when we were getting short on our production pipeline. We were off schedule, and it was really hairy. And right now, like I said, we're 7 months out from Gen Con, but I've got pieces that I'm like, my margin of error is gone.
And right? I'm mentioning this, I know we haven't even got all the way through to the miniature in our hand yet, but these are just things that you, if you are having more stuff coming down the line, knowing what to expect, it helps you set your own events better, and you'll just feel better, even if you just know, like, I'm going to get something I love from this dude, and he's always 2 months late. So I'm not going to be chewing up my own stomach waiting for him to get there. When it gets here, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah, assuming that you built that 2 months extra into it. And then what's also important about understanding this pipeline is not just knowing how long things are going to take. It's also about how much money you need to have going into the company, right? So if I want to release a miniature now, and I want to have another miniature released 2 months from now and another miniature released 2 months from then, I've got to know that way back, right? I have to calculate all that time back. That money has got to be spent probably like way before I even start selling my first miniature. So I'm not recouping those expenses, right? Assuming my miniature sells well, which would be awesome. I have no money coming in, but I've got to shell out development costs for all these things coming down the line if I want to have them coming out like that. Because like I said, you're, let's say, 2 weeks for concept art, and a month for sculpting, and 2 weeks for 3D printing. So now you're at 2 months. And let's say it takes 2 months to get master cast and production cast. Now you're at 4 months, and then you should probably at least go half again, right? So now you're at 6 months. So it's going to take 6 months probably for as a nice comfort win. You could probably get it done sooner than that. But I would not want to start on a project planning to release a miniature if I didn't have 6 months in which to do all the development and the manufacturing for that miniature.
I got you. So we're looking a conservative 6 months
between
you having the idea, getting it to an artist, turn around to have something that you can produce in your hand.
And that's assuming you've already picked all your artists.
Okay. Yeah. Fair.
That's an established pipeline.
I got it. Because sometimes there is a week or two of exchanging emails before, or text, or even a call before you really have decided, okay, you're going to be the guy who creates my hero.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've been talking with Patrick Keith for 2 weeks now, and we just sent him a contract. I sent him the signed contract. Actually, I haven't emailed it to him. I signed it and scanned it in the office today. I need to email it to him tonight.
Nice. And so now we've gone through, I guess, a kind of a windy way of describing how you finally get one thing. But to create what would be what I would consider a legitimate real pipeline is that you start the next one somewhere along that process. You don't just twiddle your thumbs and wait for, like I said, sit around just hanging out drinking margaritas for 2 months while you're waiting on your artist to get the thing back. That's when you are contacting another artist, or maybe the same artist, letting him know that he's got to do this, and that's the next thing.
Yeah, exactly right. So, like for example, when we were initially working with Adam Bernier on our illustrations, what we did for him was I blocked out the entire year. He said it's going to take me this much time to do. I need this much of a window to do every one of these pieces that you're asking me to do, this is my availability. And we blocked out like 12 months of work. So, and I sent him a calendar, like this is going to be done in this time and this is going to be done in this time. And that also lets us know, you know, it's just project management, right? That's another skill you have to learn as an independent game developer.
You gotta keep track of everything. You have to do this. And there's different ways, and I won't tell people what they should use to track this stuff, but there are tools out there, common free tools that you can even use, or even things like a whiteboard or some post-it notes. In a dedicated project space to really manage this and know, you'll know when it's time to bother the other guy if he hasn't come through yet.
Yeah, exactly right. So just today, I messaged Adam on Facebook Messenger, and I just said, just touching base on the thing. And actually, I think I touched base with everybody today. I have a couple of miniatures that Josh Qualtieri over at Zombiesmith is doing 3D printing for, and I hadn't heard from him in a week, which is unusual for Josh. So I just pinged him. I sent him a text message. I was like, "What's up, dude? What's going on with the prints?" And he said, "Yo, I've been really busy. I'm going to have them done by Thursday before I head out to the LVO." Right. And so now I know. But because we have that relationship, I've done a lot of work with him before. I know what to expect. So, you know, not hearing back from Josh for, you know, a week and a half is unusual. And now you gotta ping him.
Yeah, fair enough. I like that. So this is helpfully setting, and we code it. Let's run down the steps one more time and just say how long each step will take. And I'll let you do that. I won't interrupt.
Yeah, sure. So I'll talk about time and money. So if you have your idea, and you're going to probably spend about $100 to $300 on concept art. Let's call it $200. So you can spend $200 on your concept art. That's going to take you 2 weeks. You should probably expect that to at least take 2 weeks. And then you've got to get that to a sculptor once you've decided what your manufacturing process is and you found a sculptor that has the kind of expertise that you want to purchase, right? So you're purchasing not only his or her creativity, but you're also purchasing the expertise and being able to manufacture a usable game piece. That sculptor is gonna take at least a month. And if it's a 3D print, you're going to have to add an extra 2 weeks for 3D printing. And then you have to add probably 2 months for manufacturing, at least 2 months. And you should probably talk to your manufacturer about what their turnaround time is. But I would never guesstimate with any manufacturer anything less than 2 months. And then you should probably add time onto that, assuming there's going to be a mistake. So a nice round 6 month window from start to finish until you have like a bag of production casts in your hands and you're ready to put them in clam packs or whatever and throw them on your website and sell them. And we didn't talk about how much it's going to cost you for sculpting. Real quickly, there's a couple of price bands. You can get a sculpt for like $200 to $300, and that's a certain kind of artist does that. And you can get a sculpt for like $400 to $600. It's another kind of sculptor. And then there's sculptors that are $1,000 and above. So you might be $1,000 to $2,000. That's another kind of sculptor. But let's say you're working around $500. So you got $300 or $200 in concept art, $500 in sculpting. That's $600 to $700. And then 3D printing is probably going to be $100 or plus. And so you add those costs in there, and then resin mastering or any kind of mastering, $100 to $200. Let's call it $200 for mastering. Well, let's call it $100 because sometimes mastering happens with a big group of miniatures. Let's say $100 on average. So $200 for concept art, $500 for sculpting, $600 to $700 plus $100 for 3D printing and $100 for mastering. That's $900. So you're probably looking at least $1,000 in development costs to produce your miniature.
It's one miniature.
Yeah, one miniature, probably at least $1,000. There's going to be some wiggle room in there. Like if you're doing like a soldier that's in the same uniform and all you're doing is changing the pose up a little bit, you're going to shave off some sculpting costs, right? And you're going to shave off a little bit of mastering costs. If you have like 10 miniatures that are ready to go in a master mold, that one master mold might cost you $100. And the production mold might cost you $80. But in general, I usually consider it to be about $1,000 to produce a single miniature in development costs before you start paying for the actual production, because it's going to be like, you know, this much per miniature to manufacture it.
Man, I'm never getting my game off the ground.
Yeah, that's why it's great to be a sculptor, because you save some of those costs.
Yeah, I don't do it. I don't have any of that.
Yeah, so it's going to cost you $1,000. And think about that. It's another thing, like just for the economics of it. Keep that in mind. Whenever you go to buy miniatures, especially from a small company like Bombshell Miniatures or Redbox Games or Twisted or, you know, any of these little companies, you look at that $5, $8, $10 miniature, that's $1,000 at least in development costs, maybe more. Plus the cost of goods sold, right? Plus how much it costs to cast that miniature and box that miniature and, you know, ship that miniature to you, right? So usually, like I said, I think on another podcast, I might have said that it should take you about 200 to 300 sales of a miniature before you've made back your development costs. And in this space, that's a lot. That's a lot of sales.
No, it definitely is. That's a whole lot. But that's at least setting expectations for people that maybe have an inkling to do this.
Yeah, exactly right. So if you look at a lot of Kickstarters, a lot of these small company Kickstarters that raise about, you know, $15,000 to $30,000, if you look at the backer numbers, you're probably looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 to 400 backers. That's a solid Kickstarter to pay back your development costs, right? That's what you got to keep in mind. That little Kickstarter is probably only getting you to black in terms of paying back the money you put into development.
But that sometimes that's all people want.
Yeah, sometimes that's all people want, and they just want to make their thing, get it out there, break even, and they're happy.
They did it.
Yeah, exactly right. So if that's your goal, that's fine. You know, 200 to 400 backers, you're probably okay, especially if you've managed costs a little bit more and shaved off a little bit here or there.
And we'll talk about that. At least I think we can have a real good discussion about some solid budget spend. Like, say you have an account that you have set aside just for this. How do you use some of that money in there the smartest way possible, specifically for this design? And I think we could have a whole other show about it.
Yeah, well, the short answer before we even get to that show is the miniatures are going to cost you the most, hands down. Of anything you do, the miniatures are going to cost the most. Like, we might have, like, I think at this point we have like $50,000 into Mindworm Games, which sounds a little crazy. but bear in mind, like, I renovated a workshop and I bought equipment and whatnot, and we've done a full production run that probably is like $25,000 of retail product. But anyhow, we have like $50,000 into Mindworm Games now, and a huge portion of that was sculpting for our first production run. Sculpting for our first production run cost us more than every single piece of my equipment that I have in the workshop right now.
I believe it. I mean, you hear all the time, you know, how much what a company has to do to recoup some of these amazing figures that we see. Why we don't see, you know, why don't we always see the figures that we want?
Yeah, because, exactly right.
Because of this we just described it on a very micro level, but this is the reason why.
And just as an aside, that's why I usually recommend people get into doing their own production, because like I said, I've got a workshop full of stuff. I've got two spin casters and two vulcanizers. I've got a CNC mill. I've got melt pots. I've got, you know, all the various tools that go with that, like ladles and all this other crap. I got tables. I've got pegboards on my wall. All of that stuff costs me less money, less investment than paying an artist to sculpt 20 miniatures. So it behooves one, I think, in this space, especially because you can get a really low profile spin casting setup. It behooves you to, if you're starting a company, to learn how to do that manufacturing yourself, because you're going to save yourself a ton of headaches. That 2-month turnaround time for production, for me, it's a week. And that's if I don't feel like, you know, taking a day off of work, taking a sick day.
Well, Benson, this has been a great talk. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing these insights. Again, for those listening now, I am going to have another segment following this one. And then after that one, I'll have the original segment with Benson where we talked about, where we kicked this conversation off in the first place.
Which is super exciting. I love hearing myself talk.
I'm glad you do the proper setup with the audio. I've passed that along as the other potential guest.
Well, I will say my general philosophy in all things Mindworm Games and in business is I like to make things as if I want to do something, if I want to be engaged with somebody, like if I want to, you know, be on your podcast or do other shows, I want to give you as high quality of an experience as that I can. And you know, like I said, like it, you know, it's a little bit of an investment, but like this microphone cost me $100, but compared to the, you know, tens of thousands of dollars I've spent on, you know, sculpting miniatures, $100 is not a big deal, right? But it makes a big deal on a show like this. So that's another thing about where to spend money. Like, you know, what expenditures are going to make a big difference, and what can you just avoid?
Cool, man. Well, have a good rest of your night, and we'll catch up again really soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, man.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
Hey everybody, welcome to a special segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined this evening by Chris Dodson.
Hi.
Chris, man, thanks for joining me. I know everyone's saying, like, what is going on? Who the heck is Chris? Chris, you are a professor, like a qualified, like, master's degree in gaming professor for the Savannah College Art Design in Atlanta.
That's right. I'm a gamer that's infiltrated polite society.
I'm really happy to have you on the show. You and I go way back. That may come out during the course of this talk, but I've been doing a series, and it's turned into a series anyway, about how to get started in the gaming industry. Like, what are some things that people, if they have a game, they want to bring it into the 3D world, how do they do it? Like a tabletop game or whatever. How do they do it? And I thought you'd be a great person to reach out to just because, you know, you've got experience and you talk to people on a daily basis about this stuff.
Yeah, actually, and what I'm largely I've focused on is actually prototyping and helping people to sort of incubate, get a game idea together, rapidly prototype it, get that idea out, and then find somewhere that maybe they can take it to the next level.
So when you say rapid prototype, you mean actually get a physical copy up to where they can show people? What do you show them at conventions? You show potential distributors? What does that mean?
Well, prototyping can be either digital or it can be non-digital. And the product might be a video game or it might be a board game or a non-digital game. We kind of deal with all of that. In general, I encourage people to start non-digitally anyway. So we always try to, a lot of students come in and they don't have the board gaming experience. So they have a lot of video game experience and they've just played Nintendo games or something like that. And so we have to introduce them. We have a huge game library where we go get board games out and basically show them what's already been done and understand that games are actually something that exists as a play experience outside of any given medium. So what we're trying to do is find that play experience. What experience are you trying to create for your user, and how can you best? So by prototyping over and over, it's you know, you think of that as a lot of play testing and iteration quickly. So if it's digital, we don't want to get too wrapped up into the technology. And so sometimes non-digital is better to go with that. So we want to make sure the idea is a really good idea before you totally dive into.
Dude, I like what you're saying. I like what you're saying. I actually, over the holiday season, I got my oldest son the Super NES Small Edition with all the preloaded games on that. Just to almost like, I got it to him for him to play, but I feel like if he plays it, it's going to train his brain to be better at certain things that he wants to do.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like playing Kid Icarus and Legend of Zelda and the original Metroid and Castlevania and stuff. I think they are different than the games that we see now, but I think that they have a firm foundation into how to make some of those games and why they were fun in the first place and what's going to make fun now. I mean, do you have any experience with those or any insight with that?
Oh yeah, actually we have a really big game lab down at SCAD Atlanta, and we've got all the consoles and board games and whatnot. And so that's kind of a thing we can go into study. We do a lot of game deconstructions. So that's kind of a fancy name for, I guess, what a lot of gamers do anyway, when they're basically trying to really analyze and understand as a gamer how to be good at a game. But then I take them to think about it as a designer. Well, how is this game actually made? And what are the really core gameplay components here? And how are those similar? And what's been done before? You've got to go back and look in any artistic medium, and games are an artistic medium. You have to go back and look at what's been done before. And so you understand when you're reinventing, when you're recombining, the great cliche book at SCAD is Steal Like an Artist, and talks a lot about this idea of going back and knowing what's been done before you and how do you recombine that. And in fact, most games at this point, they're so involved, and we've seen so many ideas already, that what you're really doing is trying to find what's kind of the new thing you're going to bring to gaming. What is your big new idea, and how do we push that and not get wrapped up in, oh my gosh, this thing can't look like anything I've ever seen before. So, you know, when they come in and they're coming up with a new idea or talking about some great new game with, you know, next gen graphics or whatever, a lot of times we'll go, well, let's just go back to 90 whatever, or even the 80s, and see a game that was already, you know, made at that point. And where did this evolve?
Well, obviously we're a miniature gaming podcast, so I'd like to talk about the things that evolve around miniature gaming itself. And prototyping, I think, has a lot, keys in very well with that.
I love miniature gaming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have played, you and I have played, like, countless board games and stuff that all have some type of 3D miniature type component to it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So if someone wants to get into that type of thing, what are, and with the prototype thing in mind, what are some tips and stuff that you would, and lay it out very, I guess, very plainly and blankly, and then we'll pick it apart, or I guess dive down deeper into it. But what are some things that you might suggest to someone that has an idea for a miniature or strategy or some type of game, and they want to bring it to the real world?
Well, I guess I'd say, first of all, you think about, kind of like I mentioned, what is it that you're going to do that's unique? Does the world need, are you just copying something? You know, why do we need this new game? What's going to be interesting and different about it? And that kind of leads
into...
It's not copying,
Chris. It's an homage.
That's right. But find that one thing that you realize, okay, a lot of these problems have already been solved for you. You know, all the combat engines that are out there, you know, I love Malifaux, and they kind of said, all right, let's use cards. And that adds a really interesting dynamic. And, you know, 40K has worked out. Everybody's worked out the math for dice and D6s. And you've got all. So what are you kind of going to do that maybe that's already been done, but what is your new take on it? Or what is something that's going to make the play experience unique? A lot of times that might, people can get a little bit lost. I'm sort of a purist game mechanics person as a designer. And so I understand there's these cool universes and there's these cool narrative, all the narrative color, and it might be some new sci-fi thing. And all that might be cool. Maybe nobody's seen, you know, lately we've been getting, let's mix everything together kind of stuff. Let's get our steampunk fantasy sci-fi,
Frog
whatever.
Frogmen with missile launchers.
Right. But that's story and all that's fine, but that's not gameplay. So what is your gameplay that when I sit down, and the great thing about prototyping, so, you know, you get that idea now, and then what you do is, and here's a great recommendation for everybody, go to a dollar store and for $10, pick up, you know, cheap cards, firemen, whatever, go to thrift stores and find an old board game, and you just want all these pieces. What you want is a lot of pieces, note cards, tape, anything like that, and you build a prototyping kit. It's one of the first things I have my students do is build a prototyping kit. And I get my prototyping kit out, and I want to be able to sit down and work out an idea, because here's the key.
So if prototyping you're having, kit is tokens and chits and things that people feel comfortable using as game pieces.
And there are things that you won't get attached to in terms of if you go grab your really cool, awesome, painted whatever, and you're using that, then you get attached to it.
If you're playing a race car game and you have the coolest looking figure for your race car, you have the coolest looking race car, it may influence how you rule and change things for that figure because it's the coolest look.
And you're attached to it. This is a rule for all art, right? So if you start getting too far down the road in concept art, you start thinking that you can't let go of that. And we have a saying, you know, kill your pets. And you've got to be able to go, this isn't fun. So as I was going to say, the key is that you've got, if you can have fun with paper clips and tape and little, you know, plastic meeple guys or whatever, and you're having a good time, you found the gameplay. That's what you're looking for. And then when you throw the cool art on top of it, man, it's going to be awesome.
That's pretty interesting. So one, I would like to address that they let you say your phrase there at a liberal school. Is that true?
What's that?
They'll let you say your kill your pets phrase at an art school.
Oh, well, you know, I will say this about SCAD and you know, there's the whole liberal college thing. But honestly, what you have at my college is a lot of hardworking professional designers who just don't really want to be. You find that when you get into the top end of all creative fields, people actually just don't have time for that stuff. They're out making amazing movies, you know.
Practical thing, though, there is that theory that you just described is if you can create an entertaining experience with matchsticks, with gummy bears, with whatever it is, then that will translate even, that will have a magnitude higher when you add the cool stuff on top of it.
Absolutely. And it's a little bit of an elusive concept that sometimes people, was a few years back a really big argument, are games art? And what a lot of people get mixed up about is that they think of art as the visuals or the miniatures. And although that is all true, games as an art form are about a dynamic play experience, and that creates an emotional response. And so that is our medium as game designers. That's what you're trying to do, is that play experience. It's not something that is the visuals. And so it's all to everybody's had that moment where they go, this game looks amazing and I'm completely bored, right? So the gameplay experience wasn't there. That's what's got to be there. And if that gets there and you get it right with the aesthetic, you really sell the fantasy. There was a great extra credits about selling the fantasy.
This is important because I just hosted a segment to where one of the first steps that another company had suggested, and I also believe this as a path to victory, is getting the right art. Deciding on the art is one of the early steps.
Yeah, and I think probably that, you know, when you're coming from that perspective, you've probably got a game that you have probably done some testing with and you feel like it's going to be pretty good.
Okay,
but you have to start that early on. I would say if all you do is consider the art, you have to consider them both. If you just think about the art, you know, I play Malifaux and I love it. But as a designer, I could tell what happened when that game first started was it was a bunch of miniature guys and got together and made a game. And it was, let's throw some designers in there and figure that all out. And it went through an evolutionary period where the community kind of ended up playtesting it. And now it's in a really nice edition. And you see this happen a lot of times. So, you know, that gameplay and the art have to go together. So sometimes games start with the art, but did the gameplay really get nailed? You know, and you kind of know, some people get into, for example, because here's the problem, right? Let's take 40K. So if you read about, I played Space Marines for years. So, you know, you read these great Space Marine books, and this is awesome. And you're like, man, these guys are cool and whatever. And you put them on the table, and you're like, I'm pretty sure the Space Marine is the worst dude in the universe after playing these guys, right? Like, how does that guy...
After putting him back in the box for 10 games in a row, what happened?
Yeah, you're like, how is that the cool guy I just read that totally went into this chaos planet and annihilated everything? So there's always that weird disconnect between that aesthetic you're trying to sell and the actual play experience. Does it actually deliver that? And you've got to get those two things right.
Okay, I like that. So prototyping is what the subject, to bring us back. I know we're going to jump around. What are your suggestions? And then tell me some things that you would, some failures maybe that you've seen along the way when people are trying to produce this.
So get yourself some cheap prototyping materials, get your idea down, and write yourself down a core set of what I would call, we call design values. And that is kind of like your tower across the swamps of Mordor. That's the thing you're trying to get to, that is, as much as you get lost, remember what you were trying to create in the first place. What is that experience? And so you kind of write that down. Is it a fast paced? Is it competitive? And you look for that as you go. And that what that does, when you prototype, you're doing rapid iterations. So you're testing and you're saying, that didn't really work, or that did work. Oh, that was something cool that just happened. Well, that thing that just happened there, you know, you have this moment where you go, that was cool. All right, everybody write that down. Let's push more of that, right? And then you go back and you kind of rewrite your rules a little bit. And then you say, all right, let's try it again. And you don't keep it too complicated. You don't want to have too many things early on. You're just really looking for that core of what the game is all about. There's a tendency to want to throw in all the super crazy details and super extra abilities of every one guy. And you want to sort of avoid that. You want to try to get the core, what I'd call kind of engine down, especially in miniature gaming. You always have some kind of combat engine. You want to get that down, and then you'll eventually build around into scenarios. And
I believe that you mean just the way to interact with other figures.
Yeah. So, you know, in a video game, that would be a bunch of code and whatnot. But in its essence, what we're talking about is, you know, how does my guy attack your guy? And then what are all the steps involved in? Does he have armor? Does he have different kind of weapons? How does that get resolved? And how does that, that's going to form the basis of your balance and the little bit of the stylization of, well, this guy's fast and lithe and whatnot, and he's knocked by, maybe he doesn't have as much armor or health, that kind of thing. What are all those numbers and stats you're using? They really are very similar in so many games. You can nitpick, you know, the way you're going to do it, but getting that core engine down, are you using dice? Are you using cards? What kind of dice are you using?
Yeah, what number? What type of dice you're using is huge. If you're using a D6, the math is, you know,
and you need to go look at your and you've got to go know enough about probability to. I always tell my students the hardest thing about being a game designer is you have to know everybody else's field. So suddenly you're deep into probability math. And, you know, okay, I've got to know that stuff. I didn't pay attention in school. I didn't care. And now that's huge, because that creates, do you want a combat engine that feels highly random, like Dark Age? I did a lot of playtesting with Dark Age when it was turning into its latest version, and you know, Cool Mini or Nots in Atlanta. And so we, one of the classes actually did a little play testing with them, and that's got a D20 system. So it's highly random versus the real smooth probability curves you get out of a lot of D6s and things like that.
Oh, my goodness. Even playing a D10 game, you go down and like play testing D10 games, like, okay, well, don't break my system. Like, well, sorry, it's only on a D10. So
right.
Like I can do that and without even trying. Yeah.
Right. And there's a sort of a principle that you can adhere to, which is a strategy versus randomness sort of kind of deal. So games that as your numbers get open up to be more random, if you want, your game is going to feel more lucky, more, it's going to be more luck based.
Oh, there's a whole science behind that. And let me caveat right. that also. Like, I don't believe that you should introduce false complexity into your games. And this is just me as a user. I'm not putting words in your mouth or any other designer we get on here. I'm just saying that I don't think you should introduce complexity for complexity's sake into your games.
Yeah, and I agree with that. There's a saying, actually, there's a term I like that's called simple complexity. And it's just simply the idea that you want as few elements as possible as you can get that create a lot of complex emergent interaction, so that we're not remembering tons of rules. And this is actually King's War, I believe. It was Alessio that went and rewrote that whole system and said we wanted to get the rules down to 8 pages, and everybody was like, that's crazy for a war game. But he was really going for this idea of simple complexity. How can I keep just the basic things together?
Age of Sigmar went and turned it to 4.
Yeah, 4. Well, there's a difference in just not having actual rules. So I have a love-hate relationship with Games Workshop.
Taking this on a path. I guess I'm agreeing with you as the fact that just because that someone can do the math on a D6 or a D10 doesn't mean that you should switch to a D20 or a D8 to shake people, as that you have right. to figure out what the actual scope and design of your system is, and then make the complexity for the mind around whatever that is.
Right. And that's, so to go back to some of those terms, that play experience are what we'll often call a play aesthetic, a feel. You know, it's a feel. We get a feel when we play a game. What do you want your game to feel like? Do you want it to feel highly random and chaotic? Do you want it to feel very controlled and strategic? How much do you want your players to be able to calculate? Because if you get completely strategic, basically you've made chess, you know, where all the information is known, and it becomes a problem of just keeping up with crushing amounts of knowledge about how things are going to play out.
Well, that's the ability. Only if your opponent knows how things are going to play out. You could forgo right. all of that if your opponent doesn't know any of that.
Yeah, and if you start random elements at the idea of uncertainty, and uncertainty is actually kind of exciting. So, a lot of miniature games like to have that uncertain element, and it's always kind of a struggle between how much do you avoid frustrating your players, because I mean, we all know that perfect calculation for, you know, I've got all the right leadership roles or whatever, and then the one time we roll that 12 and I can't believe that your rhino just chased down my terminators off the board. You know, I've had that happen to me, and like, because of a 12, you know, and so, all right, well, that's a play experience that I just had. And some people are extremely frustrated by that because they want to calculate for all of that. And this comes down to, you've really got to decide who your target audience is, or what kind of gamer are you targeting? Because do you want the more strategic gamer? Do you want we all like our strategy, but you know, how tolerant is your player base going to be of random things happening? And you'll get a lot of raging on forums and that kind of stuff about this, you know, where I don't like these random elements, I do. And eventually a player base, you're eventually going to find out who your players are, and they'll settle out into the kind of their own community of people who like your style.
Let me bring us back to the prototyping side of things. I feel okay. like maybe we've jumped past that because we've established that the prototyping could be almost anything. It could be poker chips. It could be nickels. It could be box games that you get from the thrift store.
Right.
But the idea of it, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, the idea of it is to have this set of pieces and pawns and whatever that you may not necessarily have an undue attachment to.
Yeah, you don't get too attached, and you realize it's really the stats that you're interested in. It's the numbers, it's the interactions that you're interested in.
The stats and the fun. Like, if you could build a whole game, if you can accomplish what's in your mind with all the same piece, like 50 pennies or whatever, then you're probably on the right track for having a fun game, a game that other people might like.
Yeah. Yeah, you've brought up the dirty word, fun, and it's interesting.
Oh, that's a dirty
word.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, the funny thing about that is that there is a big saying in the industry with designers, finding the fun, and that's a big deal. That you've nailed that. That's exactly what you're really trying to do, is find the fun. The thing is, the word fun descends into a bunch of arguments between people about what is fun. So I recommend, for anybody who wants to get a little bit more into that, you can look up, there's a document online called the MDA framework, and it has to do with mechanics, dynamics, and aesthetics. And I won't get into all of that dry stuff right now, but you can download the document. And basically what it is doing is it's taking the idea of fun and saying, let's break that down into, like, you know, these different play aesthetics. And so instead of saying, is something fun or not? We say, well, which kind of fun are we after? And now we don't have, somebody can say, well, I don't think that's very fun. You say, well, I was going for a cutthroat competitive type play experience. You might not like that. That's why you don't think it's fun. But people who like that are going to think that's fun. So you want to define what those aesthetics are as you're prototyping, because that's the point. You're trying to find that experience. And when I say play experience, usually the word that is used is fun. Find the fun.
I'm with you.
But
I think I follow.
You want to be a little more discerning than that. You want to really say, what specifically am I defining as fun?
Let me rephrase. If you can capture the play experience that you were going for with a handful of pocket lint, Cheetos, or pennies, then you're probably on the right track.
Absolutely. That's what you're looking for right there. That is the point of prototyping.
Okay. So when you get to that stage and then go past it, I think that's what we were about to talk about.
Yeah. Now, you are also trying to answer certain questions at some point, and prototyping will generate questions for you. Well, how are we going to handle this? Oh, this new thing came up. You know, how are we going to deal with, you know, this weird interaction that's shown up? And you know, depending on the game, it could be a lot of different things, but you will move more into balance issues and problems like that, scenario issues. And these questions are going to start coming up, and you want to write them down as sort of points. And instead of trying to handle it all at once, pick the thing that you're going to sort of try to solve that day. All right, we're going to prototype. We just want to prototype. You know, maybe we've got the combat engine we're kind of down with that. And now we're trying to introduce this new set of stasis-oriented abilities where people get maybe paralyzed or whatever. And okay, how are we going to, let's sort of just address that. And you might even go so far as, one of the problems, sit down every time and just start the game from scratch. You get about halfway through it every time. So you may want to go ahead and say, let's just go ahead and create a scenario that we know we often get to and start with that. And let's now kind of run simulations, not get too wrapped up in, because the idea of the word rapid is critical. You want to keep moving. You want to keep iterating, you know, do over and over and over again. So you solve those problems individually as they
come up. I think that's
important.
And from a business side, I've got a way that I deal with things. Like, this is one of the questions I ask when I'm interviewing people and when I'm just trying to get an idea of how they think. I give them the scenario. There's an office building and people are packed outside waiting to get in the office building. The elevators, they're all in line for the elevator. And it makes people late for work. And so by 9:35, the line is around the building for people trying to get in the elevators. What's the problem?
Yeah.
That's what I ask. Exactly. Like, what's the problem? And inevitably, everyone says, or I should say, most people say, some solution is the problem. They'll tell me that I don't have enough elevators or something close.
Right.
And that's stating a solution in the problem. That's not stating what the actual problem is.
Right.
And I think that's
one of the afflictions of being, one of the afflictions of being a design oriented person is that you walk around and you see all that stuff everywhere, you know,
right. Like, what's the problem? Well, we don't have enough elevators. So what are we going to do? We're going to tack up a bunch of elevators on the side of the building. Is that really the problem? Is that anywhere line
right
and close to where our solution is? No, but that's one of the suggestions that they give. And I think that what you're suggesting, or what you're detailing anyway, is not doing that.
Yeah. So you want to isolate those issues. Another thing that people get really trapped by is getting really drawn into, and this is very similar to art, they get really trapped by nouns and names and what you really want to do. So, you know, you've called somebody a ranger now, and now everybody's arguing over if it should be called a ranger or if it should be called a scout or whatever. Rangers do this and rangers do that. And so all this association, and you're like,
are they dark elf rangers?
Right. Yeah. We don't want to deal with any of that stuff. We'll just call them Moogly Moogs. You know, we don't care. And you can go back later. You know, it's like the Beatles, the whole story of the Beatles. The song Yesterday was called Scrambled Eggs, because they'll fill that all out later. You know, that's not important. The idea is to get the experience down. And I have literally been, and actually, Paul, you've probably been in these, you know, hour-long discussions over what something should be called, which is not the point. You know?
Is it a plum that he ate? Is it an apple?
Yeah.
Why do we, I mean, to 3 a.m. to try and decide which one it was. Like,
does, so you got to avoid getting too label-oriented when you're in that prototyping stage. That stuff's not that relevant. Love it. You'll get all that worked out later.
I like what you're saying, though. You are really trying to hone it in on the experience of, I mean, essentially what would be your customers, what will eventually be your customers that you are trying to hone in on their experience.
Right. And you actually want to go through a few stages with this. So what you want to do is you want to start out just whoever is making the game, the designers, and you get them kind of testing. Because inevitably, if you try to bring in outside playtesters too soon, they will comment on everything but what you want to be commented on. They get wrapped up in all kinds of stuff that isn't done. Hey, well, why don't you should add in some, you know, some shotgun guys. And you're like, we're not even there yet, you know, that kind of thing. So early on, you're
like, I just want to know what happens if you jump out of the speeder wearing orange pants. That's right. All I want to know.
Right. So you want to bring those people in, but you want to make sure the game's in enough of a state to where that you can actually do it in some sort of an organized fashion. You can actually do survey sheets. One of the big thing when you get into that stage, so after you've done some internal testing and you're happy as designers, now we're gonna go get what we call confidant testers. So they're people who are a little more knowledgeable. The more game-oriented, game design-oriented people you can get in there are experienced gamers, and you can let them know, you understand this is still a mess. Just play it, and let's not get too wrapped up in rules yet, just play. That's better. And then so you can start taking a lot of notes and get feedback. And what you have to do is avoid the trap of getting into these rules design arguments with the playtesters, right? You're just like, okay, cool, that's really good feedback. You try to say as little as possible. You don't want to explain too much about it, because if they don't understand what's going on, you obviously haven't done your job. We have a rule amongst interactive designers and game designers. There are no bad players. There are only bad designers. So if your players don't, and that's just sort of the stance you have to take. If your users, this whole field of UI, UX, that's all the rage. It's just going back to saying, you got to take that point of view. If your users don't understand what's going on, where have you failed to communicate that to them in some way? Whether that's a rule book, in the play experience, somewhere, in the miniatures, you know, there's something ambiguous.
Well, it's important to remember, though, that if you do create something and send it off into the wild, you're not going to be at everyone's table.
Right. So you want to get as many of those testers as possible. And at some point, you just run into the problem that you'll never solve all those problems until you have put it into the hands of thousands of people out there. And then all those things you never thought were going to happen are going to show up. But you're just trying to get as much of that out of the way as possible ahead of time. So after that kind of confidant stage, you will want to move on to just like, let's just grab some gamers. Who's kind of my target audience? You'll probably get maybe some people that aren't even in your target audience, just to kind of see what that outside perspective is like. And you really just want to watch and listen and pay attention. Of course, I'm talking about the stage where you'd actually have enough rules written down to where, you know, they can actually read through that and understand it. But you kind of can present it in like a demo way. A lot of times, like when you go to a con, here's the demo of the game, we've set it up for you, kind of deal like that. And watch how they react. You're looking for things like, sometimes even people take pictures or video when we do this. We actually have playtest times. We'll bring in industry people, different people like that, and we'll test and we watch the reactions. When do people go, yo, everybody has that whoa moment, you know, and judge the reactions, which things are frustrating them, because you're going to get to a stage where you realize that games are always an abstraction. There was an era early on in gaming where everybody wanted to go simulation crazy, which basically means they were trying to make like, hey, you know, you have to. You know, the game masters back in early tabletop role playing that made you have to get up and go to the restroom every 5 minutes, you know, whatever. It's just like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? We don't need this level of minutia. And now games have evolved to the point where we understand its abstractions. Let's get to the few things. The rules should be about what really matters and what creates the fun. Let's get all that other stuff out of the way. So a lot of design is actually cutting things out. And so you're going to get to that phase after enough prototyping where you're like, this really isn't adding anything to the play experience. This is just slowing everything down. It's cumbersome.
You could be attached to that. And I guess what I'm asking is you could actually be, no, this is really cool. I needed my guys, my people to understand that they had to shoe their horses or make sure they put their armor in a certain position at night, or it wouldn't function the day after or whatever.
Right, and that kind of detail can be great. So the best games figure out how to incorporate that in a way that it just sort of elegantly works itself in. You're like, oh, that's a really cool little rule. You know, it just kind of handles all these things instead of 10 rules that handle
its own phase. It's the upkeep at night phase, to where if you don't do these things, then things suffer the next day or whatever. It's all compensated into one thing.
Right. So you know, but you've got to decide what you're going to cut out, what you're going to, some of that is how long do I want this game to play? There's a big push now in the industry where you want that hour to 2 hour play experience. You know, we used to play, I mean, you remember our old, I'll never forget one of those 40K game where that was 4Hammer Fantasy, and we were absolutely determined to play down to the very last man. And there's a wood elf general flying around with a bow of lore and shooting at everybody, right?
Until
to the last guy. That's right. And those were those days, because we didn't have that many games and we were so into the ones we had. It was cool. But now it's kind of like, I got a life. I have an hour or two. I want to get that Warhammer game in. I don't want it to take all my time. And so rules have moved to a state where how do we just focus on what's really going to be important, what's really going to create the fun, and wrap, you know, WizKids are great with handling little interface things like X-Wing, where, look, this stuff just handles all that. You can play X-Wing in no time, and there's a lot of complexity and strategy and just using templates. I'm sorry. Well, it was I used to play Star Wars. Star Trek. And so I started off with Star Trek, and I had all that stuff. That was those guys. And then everybody switched to X-Wing. So then I had to go buy X-Wing. So yeah, it's Fantasy Flight, which is an awesome company, by the way. Fantasy Flight's fantastic.
I think they're killing it.
Yeah, I really, really like their work. I have a lot of Fantasy Flight games. So
on a good track. I'm sorry I took us off.
No, you're actually good correction. Like I say, I was the one guy sitting there going, anybody want to play Star Trek? But then the board came out and nobody wanted to play anymore. So. It was too much like the movies. It was very accurate. So.
But isn't that, in itself, a flaw, though? Like, because they were probably holding on to that that idea that it had to be a certain way?
Well, the thing you have to realize about everybody should really think about, because we as gamers can be terribly critical, is, you know, game designers, the industry is full of some of the smartest people anywhere. And they're just trying to make a cool experience, and it's hard. These are hard design decisions, and you don't always know the implications. And when somebody sits down and says, you got this IP like, Star Trek, and somebody's like, okay, we got to design the Borg now. I want to know what that meeting was like. Oh my God, what are we going to do? Everybody knows the Borg just kill everything. How is this even going to be reasonable? And I don't know what that discussion was like, but finding a way that it actually feels correct and that it's going to actually deliver the narrative expectation, but that the game mechanics aren't unbalanced. That's hard stuff sometimes. It's a lot. That's one of the reasons it can be a lot easier when you're working around your own universe and your own narrative world, because
you're not stuck with so many sacred cows. You know,
yeah.
But you can find a way to get around them.
Yeah. There was an era in design where if a game had a big IP from a movie associated with it, you knew it was just probably going to be horrible. You know, there's the E.T. story of the landfill mines of the E.T. game. And it took people realizing, okay, we actually need game designers. And that's one of the toughest challenges, I think, is going into
like
an IP.
All the Middle-earth card games.
Right. And just, okay, wow, you know, how are we going to do this in such a way? Superman games are a great example. Like, what are you going to do, Superman? He always wins, unless there's kryptonite. How much of a fun game is that? Kryptonite, I lose. No kryptonite, I win. Right. So how do you design around that? Right. That's not an easy thing to deal with.
That's funny. That's exactly. I think that's a perfect way of describing it.
Right.
You know, we're talking about prototyping and how to get something on the table and the things to be most concerned about when you are doing it. And I think we've hit most of the points here. So it's probably a good idea to close this out. But I'd love to have you on again, talk about some other phases of this process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anything else you want to talk about the prototyping thing that you think we might have missed?
Well, prototyping, we'll just say that you get to that point where you're happy with it, and the next topic from that people are going to be more, you know, versed in all of that is how do you actually then do something with that to get it out to other people. But when we talk about prototyping, we're really just talking about getting something that you finally feel confident about taking to someone to show and pitching to and showing them that you have found the fun. So I would just say ultimately find that fun. Don't get too attached to the things that don't matter. Look for that play experience, iterate, test. And that's, if you stick with those things and you really put time and you really don't get distracted by all the other stuff, you'll find what you want. You'll find that game you're after.
Cool, man. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time with me today.
All right, sure.
We'll see you.
All right. See you, man. Bye.